Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We're sitting down with D.C.'s Police Chief Peter Newsham tonight. It's the first interview of the new year on this program, but some of the old problems remain, and we only have a few minutes to sit down and talk with him tonight, so we may take a few calls, but we're going to get right into this conversation, of course. Phone number 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Chief, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Harold, Happy New Year. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you. Let's talk about the mayor's walk around Ward 3 today, and not so much specifically Ward 3, but she does this about every month or so. What kind of information do you and the mayor expect to get out of these walks?
You know, it's really about the way that I see it anyways is for the mayor to get out and hear firsthand from the community about concerns that the government can address. And so I go on these walks with the mayor quite frequently. If I'm not there, there's a representative from the police department, maybe the district commander, to really hear what the community is saying face to face about, you know, the issues. For us, it's about crime, but you also have all the other government agencies represented there. And it's really kind of interesting to watch. They actually do a punch list. So if you come to one of those walks, you have a specific concern that the government should be addressing. They put it on a punch list, and then the mayor's team holds the agencies accountable for ensuring that it actually gets fixed. So I think if you have an issue, the government's responsible for correcting it. The mayor shows up, she give you a face to face, and then she turns around and she makes sure the thing gets fixed. And I think that's, I think for the community to see a mayor who's willing to do that, meet you face to face and address your issues is important.
One of the things that you and the mayor, and not only in your administration, but in the previous police administration under Kathy Lanier, you talked about removing guns off the street in order to stem the violence. And just a week or so ago, the mayor talked about the guns coming into Virginia, more of them coming from Virginia than Maryland. Can you talk to me briefly about what's the philosophy behind that? Where are people getting guns from? No matter where they come from.
So, yeah, when you're in the business of police and you try and look at where the guns are coming from, particularly when you live in a city like Washington, D.C., we don't have any gun stores in the District of Columbia. We don't manufacture guns, but we still have this persistent problem with gun violence like many major cities. And so, you know, you look to what you call the source states. Where are the guns coming from? And right now, the largest source state for guns that are recovered in the District of Columbia is the state of Virginia. A lot of that has to do, and if you look at Maryland's a perfect example. Maryland used to be very similar to Virginia with regards to the number of guns that were coming into our city. But the number of guns coming from Maryland has actually reduced because Maryland did some changes to their laws. And then you asked, how does it happen? Primarily, we do have some people that traffic in guns, so they'll buy a number of guns, they'll come and they'll sell them to people here in the city. But primarily, the way we're seeing guns get into the city, particularly from the state of Virginia, is through what's called straw purchases. And that's somebody who will go out, they'll develop a relationship with somebody out in Virginia. Mostly, it's a man, and they develop a relationship with a woman in the state of Virginia, get that woman to buy a weapon legally in the state of Virginia. They'll sell that weapon to the man. They may have the intent for using it for criminal purposes. And then the woman will then subsequently report the weapon either lost or stolen. So that's a straw purchase. One of the good things that just happened over in Virginia is the U.S. attorney over there, that's a federal crime to make a straw purchase. But he has come out very vocally and said he's going to support prosecutions for those type of purchases to help us here in Washington, D.C. with that influx of guns. And I think you know this already. The mayor actually wrote a letter to the powers over in Virginia saying, hey, listen, it's very important to us here in Washington, D.C., that you tighten up some of your laws so we can stop this flow of illegal guns and hopefully stop the gun violence here in Washington, D.C.
We're talking to D.C.'s police chief, Peter Newsham. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're only going to have him for until 7:30 tonight. Just want to keep that in mind. I want to share this with you. We talked to a couple of young people today about gun violence in the district, and this is what they shared with us.
Well, my opinion on the D.C. shootings around, well, this year and years before that and probably the years coming is that it's very terrible, especially being a teen in D.C. and knowing so many people that have got shot. But it also taught me a few lessons as well, that you have to cherish your moments with people because you never know when they're going to be gone.
Filled with gun violence, it's just terrible how you can't even go outside or talk to your friends anymore. I feel like you just have to stay inside, and that's just a terrible thing to go through.
Chief, these young people are talking about their own mortality. These are minors. What do you hear when you hear these young people talk about these particular issues, being afraid to go out on the street or not thinking that they may have a chance to make it to adulthood?
Yeah, you know, it's heartbreaking. You hear a young person saying those kinds of things in our city, in a city that we shouldn't have any homicides in the District of Columbia, particularly gun-related homicides. And so, you know, that is inspirational to a police officer to do everything we possibly can to put a stop to this. Of course, and you know, anybody will tell you this, stopping gun violence is not something the police department can do alone. It's one of the good things about working in Washington, D.C. as a police officer is we do have leadership in the city. We have a mayor who understands that, and she's getting all of the other government agencies engaged, trying to identify violence by its root causes and addressing that. One of the programs I always point to, and I think it's really going to be very successful here in Washington, D.C., is the ONES office. The Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement has what's called a Pathways program. What they do is they take these young men, primarily young men, who are at risk of either being the victim of a violent crime or being involved in violent crime. They provide them with wraparound services, and the idea is to change their life at a point where they're going down a very, very dangerous path. And I think a program like that is going to pay dividends for us moving forward into the future.
Outside of the actual use of handguns to commit homicides, before the trigger is pulled, what do you believe is actually fueling the violence in the district?
I think it's not unlike any other big city. I think there are a lot of things that influence people that is the way that you resolve disputes as you use a weapon. In some cases, if you look at or listen to some of the music that folks listen to, or you watch some of the programming and the TV and the movies that are out there, almost glamorizes the carrying of guns. There's nothing less glamorous than being on the scene of a homicide where somebody has lost their life to gun violence. You know, you look in the eyes of a mother who's lost their child to gun violence. I can tell you from personal experience, it's not glamorous. You know, on TV, it's acting. In movies, it's acting. Those people you see who are getting injured and hurt in those situations, they get back up and the next day, you know, that they're walking around. These people are gone forever. Lives are impacted. Lives are destroyed. And you know, if we can get that message out to the young people that are involved in this behavior, you can't you can prevent yourself from getting into a shooting by not carrying that gun around in the first place. You know what I mean? If you carry that gun out there, you're raising your chances of being the victim of a shooting or being the suspect in a shooting dramatically. And those are consequences that are going to last you for the rest of your life. And if we can get that in some of the folks that are involved in this behavior, if we can get that information into their heads, maybe we can change some of that behavior.
Are things different now than they were during the 80s and early 90s with the the crack cocaine culture, because of course there were lots of turf wars, and we were seeing numbers in excess of 300 homicides. Numbers still high, but not. What has changed between then and now when you're talking about homicides in the district?
It's a really significant change. So I was a police officer through that time here in Washington, and we were almost up to 500 homicides. One year, I want to say we had 489 homicides here in the district, and that's, you know, if you can imagine, there's only 365 days in a year.
And I was here, too, as well.
But and I, yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. Now you have familiarity mm-hmm. with it because you're a native Washingtonian. Mm-hmm. But what's different is really the motives for the shootings. So back in those days, a big chunk of the motives in our homicides and our shootings was exactly as you described, people fighting over turf wars where drugs could be sold. This crack cocaine had a grip on a large number of people. There were huge influxes of sales. There were a lot of people who were addicted to it. And then you had some folks out there that were taking advantage of it for financial gain and to control their enterprises, they would kill people. And you never seen anything like it. Thank God we're past those days, but you know, to have over 160 homicides in the District of Columbia is just too many. So the shift really is now what you're seeing is you're seeing the prevalence of illegal guns, and then you're seeing minor disputes that are resulting primarily. This is the biggest increase in motives that I've seen. These minor disputes that end up with somebody end up being dead. The folks that are generally involved in our homicides are people who know each other. And there are people in that high-risk category that I described. These are people who have multiple touches with the criminal justice system. And, you know, the only thing I could urge those folks to do is come on, put your guns down. Think about your family. Think about losing one of your loved ones. I don't know how you get that message, and it's largely young men, but if you can get that message into these young men's head, that, you know, you're not doing anybody any good. And you know, when you discharge that firearm in a city as small as ours, 67 square miles, you don't know where it's going to land. And we have too many stories here in the district where young kids are catching those bullets.
I'm going to shift to an issue. I'm sure you're familiar with the lawsuit filed by the ACLU here in D.C. about the frisking of a young man that happened actually a year ago today, where the suit is alleging that he was touched in a sexually invasive way. Can you talk to me a little bit about your thoughts about that incident at all?
Yeah, I can't talk about that incident in particular because we have a pending lawsuit and our lawyers would go nuts if I did. But I can tell you very generally that type of behavior is just not tolerated by the leadership at MPD. One of the things that we do have to do in Washington, D.C., we raise our hands and we take an oath to it, is that we have to enforce the laws of the District of Columbia. But the other thing that we train our people on, every single person in the agency, is that when we do enforce the laws of the District of Columbia, we have to do it safely and we have to do it respectfully. And to do an invasive search on any human being is not respectfully, and it's not something that we as an agency should tolerate.
How should someone frisk a suspect? Because realistically, we know, and this is, we're talking about suspects here, but obviously when someone goes to lock up, many of those searches are in, you know, in rear cavities and the like, men and women. But when you're on the street, we know the police officers are concerned about things that may be hurting them, as well as, you know, the possibility that contraband or weapons may be in those private places. How do you balance that?
That's a good question, and the way you asked it is exactly right. You do have to balance it. So what we always want our police officers to be safe, and you want to ensure that whenever you're involved in a stop and potentially somebody is armed, that you check them for weapons. But, you know, a more invasive search like the one you described, that's inappropriate. Particularly, it's inappropriate if it's in the public view. You don't want to embarrass another human being. You may have to conduct a search like that, but if you do have to conduct a search like that, a more detailed search, it should be done in a private area, and you got to have probable cause to do it.
Let me go to the phone lines real quick, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Cassandra, quickly, calling from Bowie, what's on your mind?
Yes, my name is Cassandra Nipper, and I'm calling from Bowie, Maryland.
Go right ahead.
And I was calling, why don't we train people, not only the people on the street, but the police as well? Like a safety center, have a boys and girls club in it, have people like programs, like drug programs and things like that, so we can train them on how to particularly deal with someone in those type of cases.
Thank you so much for your phone call, Chief. Go right ahead.
So, Cassandra, that's a good question. We spend a lot of time training our officers on a lot of different things. One of the things in particular that we try to train our officers on is those exact things. Self-awareness is one of the things we're trying to teach our officers. Sometimes officers don't realize when they're enforcing the laws how they look to the public. And that impression that a police officer leaves with the public can be very lasting. So we do have a number of things that we're teaching our officers. And then, you know, the thing that Harold and I were talking about just a minute ago, I think falls right into your question, is we're constantly reinforcing with every member of this police department here in Washington, D.C., that you have to respect somebody. And respect comes in a lot of different forms. It can come in how you speak to somebody. It certainly comes in how you have to touch somebody. One of the things that doesn't get told about our agency is, you know, we're involved in about 600,000 calls for service every year, a little over 600,000. Unfortunately, we arrest close to 30,000 people every year. And in 95-96% of those cases, our police officers don't use any force whatsoever. I think that's a pretty telling statistic, because oftentimes there you have to arrest people who don't want to be placed under arrest. So we would like it to be zero. If we didn't have to use force at all. But that's a part of respect, and I think that's a part of the things. One of the things that we do in Washington, D.C. better than a lot of other police agencies.
Real quick, Mark, calling from Northeast. You got 30 seconds, Mark. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing, Chief? I just want to ask you about the open-air drug markets that still plague our city. Places like Minnesota Avenue, the 3900 block, is really out of control. And I was wondering, what could you all do to really curtail this problem?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark. You know, we don't have the open-air drug markets like we used to here in Washington, D.C., but there are a couple of spots in our city where we do see persistent sales of drugs. And so we, on the law enforcement side, we have a responsibility for interrupting those. And if people are out there, like I said earlier, breaking the law, we place them under arrest. But I think more importantly, what we need to do is we need to find alternatives for the people who are involved in that behavior. Because arresting somebody now for a minor drug offense is not going to really change their behavior. So I think that what we need to do, and I know the mayor's on board with this, is to maybe get some folks out there who understand why they're out there, why they're in the business of selling drugs, and see if we can't find them something more productive to do. Maybe it's lack of opportunity. Maybe it's they're looking for a job. And, you know, we have a lot of resources. We have a lot of advocacy groups. We have a lot of partners here in D.C. who can provide those things. So, you know, if you got a persistent issue in your neighborhood, of course, I would never dissuade you from calling the police, and we will take whatever law enforcement steps are necessary. But I think long term, we got to find alternatives for the people who are involved in that behavior.
Chief Peter Newsham with the Metropolitan Police Department, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and hope to see you back here again real soon so we can again talk about these many issues about law and order in the district. Thank you.
Harold, you're top notch. Thanks for having me.
We are about to take a break, but again, here's a reminder. You can hear this in every edition of the Daily Drum Inside segment in its entirety via podcast on whur.com. Click on shows and drop down to podcast to find the program you want. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Angela Stribling is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll continue this conversation on the other side in just a few seconds.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, Sirius XM Channel 142, HBCU and Sirius XM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Together, we can turn a stairwell into an ER at a moment's notice. Together, we can turn a rescue ship of refugees into a maternity ward. Together, we can vaccinate 710,000 people in just 11 days. Together, we can deliver medical care where the need is greatest. Together, we are Doctors Without Borders. Doctors Without Borders goes where others don't to provide life-saving medical care to people caught in crisis situations around the world. Learn more at doctorswithoutborders.org.
Are you a diehard fan of Howard University Athletics? Looking to lend support to the Bison teams you love? Then make sure you check out Howard University's Bison Express, an organization formed by the fans of Howard University Athletics that is dedicated to providing an exceptional athletic and educational experience for the student athletes. For more information on Bison Express, visit bisonexpress.org. bisonexpress.org.
This is Renee Nash. You know, ladies, we tend to be willing to talk to each other about everything. But when it comes to our finances, we often learn through trial and error. That's why you need to tune in every Friday at 12:30 p.m. to Beyond the Bling. My colleague Muriel Garr and I, we take the mystery out of money. So check out Beyond the Bling Fridays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern right here on Sirius XM Channel 141 HUR Voices. Because, ladies, it's your money. Time to make it your business.
This is Harold Fisher. Got a question or comment for the Daily Drum and can't get through? Follow me on Twitter at HFisherWHUR and send it to me before, during, or after the program. Always on, always connected.
Since 1989, Trees for the Future has planted over 155 million trees around the world through the support of individuals like you. Together, we train farmers to plant and manage forest gardens that sustainably feed families, raise incomes, and revitalize the earth. Join Trees for the Future in planting trees that end hunger, poverty, and deforestation. Find out more by visiting trees.org/radio. That's trees.org/radio.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are continuing our discussion about law and order issues in the District of Columbia. And for the second part of this program, we are talking to Ryan Nicken. She is founder and president of the Trayron Center in Southeast D.C. And Michael Perloff is an attorney with the ACLU office here in D.C. We're going to take a bit of a turn to talk about D.C. violence and some of the other issues that are concerning to the citizens, not only in the district, but people who live in the surrounding area, specifically, obviously, as it relates to violent crime. I want to thank both of you for coming in and sharing your thoughts with me.
Great to be here. Thank you for having us.
Let me start with you first, Michael. We asked the chief about the incident, the frisking incident. Can you give me a little more detail about the lawsuit that the ACLU has filed against the police department first?
So actually, our case concerns an event that happened a year ago today. Our client, Mbalume Mmanzi, was spending some time with some friends at an apartment. He was watching some sports, and officers with the Metropolitan Police Department knocked down the door and came in to search for drugs. Now, they had a warrant to search the apartment for drugs, but the warrant didn't say anything about the people who were in the apartment. And Mr. Mmanzi was searched twice, and a third officer named Officer Joshua Wilson, knowing Mr. Mmanzi had been searched, those searches found no evidence, no contraband, no weapon. Officer Wilson chose to search Mr. Mmanzi a third time. And in executing that search, he pressed his hand into Mr. Umanzi's buttocks, causing severe pain. He reached his hands between Mr. Umanzi's legs and jammed his testicles against his leg, again causing severe pain, and repeating the action as Mr. Umanzi cried out in pain. It was appreciated to hear that the chief mention that these types of searches are not tolerated. Our concern, though, is that we've heard about many of these types of searches happening throughout the district. In fact, this case is the fourth time in recent years that we filed a lawsuit involving a sexually invasive search. So our belief is that the chief is correct to say that these types of searches shouldn't be accepted, but that it's imperative for him and for the department and for the leadership in the city to make sure that those words are being heeded by the officers, whether that's through training or through discipline. Mm.
You mentioned other cases. Are these cases still pending in the courts? What is the status of those other cases that the ACLU has attempted to address with the police department?
One of those cases is still pending, and two of the other cases settled for substantial amounts. And we think that's indicative of the fact that these are serious allegations that occurred, and that, you know, the district understood that you know, to allow these cases to proceed could be problematic for them. And so I think that, you know, more than settling cases, we need to see changes in policies and real accountability for the officers who commit these types of actions. One of the officers involved has been fired, but the charges that were brought up against him weren't actually from this incident that we sued about. They were from another incident where he was involved in a sexually invasive search. So again, it's imperative that the type of training that's necessary to stop these incidences is occurring, and based on the number of complaints we receive and the cases we filed, we're not confident that it is.
Do you believe that these invasive searches are akin to assault, or do you believe that these are just overzealous officers that are actually looking for something?
Well, I can tell you what our clients tell us, and they talk about them as assaults. And I think I've had the chance to speak with many people who have had searches of this nature. And it's extremely difficult for my clients to talk about what happened to them. It really feels like you're talking to someone who has been through a sexual assault, because I think for our clients, that's what these experiences felt like, to have someone who you don't know, someone who you're told to trust, who's in a position of authority, put their hands in the most sensitive parts of your body. And, you know, it's something that lasts with our clients and has caused significant trauma for every single one of them.
I want to turn to you, Ms. Nickens. I mentioned at the introduction, what is the Trayron Center?
So the Trayron Center is an organization that works with communities. 80% of our work is with elementary and middle schoolers who have experienced gun violence, whether it's directly or indirectly, to help them facilitate the trauma that violence brought to them.
Mm-hmm. Why did you found this nonprofit organization?
I founded the Trayron Center because of my own lived experience with gun violence here in D.C. As a native Washingtonian growing up in Ward 8, my uncle was killed in 1989 on 22nd Street in Southeast. My sister was killed, who was 8 months pregnant, was killed in Washington Highlands, that's in Southeast. And on that day, my mother and brother and another sister were also shot. A couple of years later, my brother was killed. And just last, in 2018, my cousin was shot. So this organization was founded in November 2017 because we don't talk about trauma in our community. We don't talk about, you know, the chief mentioned, you asked them about the young men committing the offenses, right?
What is fueling
these
violent actions in the district?
But we never talk about their trauma. We never talk about the cousins. They know these very people have lost loved ones, that some of them themselves have been shot, but they've never received the proper trauma care to deal with that pain. So pain begets pain. And I remember after my brother was killed, my thought was, almost to heck with everybody else and their feelings. I wasn't a violent person, but push probably on a bad day, I could have become one without my parents sent me to therapy, though, to help me deal with that. And that's that missing piece. We aren't addressing the trauma that these people, that this group, this segment has gone through. Who really, if you live in a community where you're ducking bullets, you've seen dead bodies. I seen my first dead body by the time I was 8 or 9. This is a man with his head, with his brains outside of his head. Like, these are traumatic experiences that stick with you. And it's not, they don't have to turn on their televisions to see violent crimes. Mm-hmm. They don't have to listen to the music. All they got to do is sit outside a couple of hours and they see it. Mm-hmm. So I think that we started because of my own lived experience and the fact that I saw what worked for me. And I just packaged that and brought it back to my community.
You mentioned that your uncle was shot and killed in 1989. I want to go back and play for you the two pieces of an interviews that we did with young people here in the district. And I'd like for, you know, both of you, for that matter, to react to that. But obviously, Ms. Nickens first, because in 1989, you were what? A girl. You were a little girl, young girl.
About 10, 12.
Yeah, you're pre-teenager. Mm-hmm. And so these are the young teenagers, probably just a little bit older than you were then. Your uncle died in 1989. We are now in 2020.
Well, my opinion on the D.C. shootings around, well, this year and years before that and probably the years coming is that it's very terrible, especially being a teen in D.C. and knowing so many people that have got shot. But it also taught me a few lessons as well, that you have to cherish your moments with people because you never know when they're going to be gone.
So with gun violence, it's just terrible how you can't even go outside or talk to your friends anymore. I feel like you just have to stay inside, and that's just a terrible thing to go through.
Your thoughts about what those young people were sharing with us?
That was me. That was absolutely me. Our young people deserve more than what we give them. And we wonder why they have attitudes, why they're self-medicating. Some of them choose to self-medicate that pain with alcohol, with drugs. So we don't talk about those things. We don't talk about the trauma they see every single day, and they choose to self-medicate that. I chose as a 15-year-old after my sister was killed to self-medicate my pain with alcohol. And thankful for a community that saw that and intervened, a family that intervened in that before it got out of hand. If you don't hear their pain, something's wrong with you.
Your thoughts, Mr. Perloff, about what those young people were saying, because this particular suit, this is not a child, but the ACLU in D.C. has attempted to address these same kinds of issues that affect every walk of life in the district, including young people.
I mean, to hear those statements from people that age is devastating. No one who's a teenager should have to not be able to go outside or be thinking about prioritizing their time with their loved ones. And I think that it's important to recognize that those sorts of experiences aren't evenly distributed. You know, in Georgetown, for example, you don't hear the same sorts of stories. And so I think one thing that's really consistent with what Ryan was saying is, what sort of resources are we putting into these communities? Are we investing in children's education and in them being able to have the sort of counseling that they need when they have a traumatic experience? I think there's a tendency when you hear statements like that to say, well, we need more police to go in and to try to stop people and frisk people. And I think that it's also important to recognize that children can have traumatic experiences from police officers as well. Just last spring, I think I was on here and we were talking about at that time the incidents of officers handcuffing and arresting young children. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to try to envision a community where children aren't having to run from officers who they're afraid are going to harm them or arrest them for no justification, as well as from people who are committing acts of violence from, you know, gun violence and things like that. And so I think working toward that starts with figuring out how we can invest more and create more opportunities for people so that we're developing communities that are as privileged wherever they are in the city as more so than we see right now.
Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Sylvia, calling from Bethesda. Sylvia, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you, and thank you for having this topic. My brother was killed in the gun violence in D.C., and it totally devastated our family. And then, but when we deal with, I noticed that when young people deal with the police, the way they talk to the young people, the way they disrespect them as children, they could even be on the basketball court. I have taken my nephews and my brother when he was alive, younger, to the basketball court. They're just playing basketball. And the police seemed like they were harassing them. Mm-hmm. You know, it is just very sad the way that they're being treated by the police and their peers. And so I know the chief was saying to have them not pick up a gun, but how can they not pick up a gun?
That's an interesting thought process. Ryan, talk to me a little bit about both of those things. Because I would imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, that your organization in dealing with the trauma of violence, are there discussions about how the youngest children should see the police, interact with them?
Yeah, me and Michael were talking about, you know, my children and their interactions with police officers. We are a block away from 7th District, where we run our after-school program and summer program. And our kids struggle with a police officer. They know on one hand that officer is there to protect, but they also know that officer has the potential to harass.
Yeah.
And cause more danger. So they don't know, like, they don't know if they can trust. And so they take officer by officer, experience by experience. They will call the officer an op, which is street language for police officer, and see how that officer takes that word.
So what does that mean?
It just means it's a police officer.
Okay.
There's a police officer in the vicinity. But our kids don't have a good impression of police officers.
What do you tell them about how they should deal with the officers that they encounter, whether they know them or not?
So we tell our kids, in dealing with anybody, to be respectful. And if they feel disrespected, there is a way to convey that disrespect to any adult. We don't teach them specifically how to deal with police officers because I think police officers need to learn how to deal with the community that they serve. But we teach our kids how to deal with adults in a respectful way to get their voices heard. We don't directly deal with how to deal with a police officer because I think these are elementary and middle school kids. Mm-hmm. The adult should know how to deal with a child. And not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Sylvia, thank you so much for that. And you know, as it relates, you know, Michael, to the gentleman who was involved in this lawsuit, how is he dealing with this incident? Here we are a year later, because Ryan has spoken about, trauma. Obviously, this has impacted him enough and has come to the attention of the ACLU enough where this is problematic for him. So how is he doing?
It's still very, very difficult for him. It's difficult for him to talk about this incident. It's difficult for him to deal with some of the media attention that's come to this incident. And I think that it's reflective of what you were saying before about how this really is akin to a sexual assault. I think that what's really impressive about Mr. Mamanzi is that despite how difficult this experience is for them, he is persevering and pushing through because he wants to be able to tell his own children that when he saw injustice, he didn't turn away. He took up the challenge. I think that it's also important to recognize that his experience, the trauma he's felt, is in some ways unique because of the degree of the invasion that he suffered. But every client who comes to our office and talks about an experience with a police officer often experiences some form of trauma and relays some form of trauma, because there's a difference between being harmed by a member of a community and harmed by someone who you trust to protect you, to keep you safe. And when that person comes at you and does something that violates your rights, whether it's arresting you when they shouldn't, whether it's invading your property, whether it's conducting an incredibly invasive search, that changes your understanding of who you can trust and of who respects you and of your place in society and in the community. So I think that's the added consequence of police violence, which is why even as we talk about community violence, we also need to be sure that we're not solving that problem by creating another one.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to the phone lines. Will, calling from Dallas, Texas. Will, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Harold. For one, I hate to be the devil's advocate. I look at D.C. compared to some of the other cities and then some of the other bigger cities as well. But where I don't understand, me as just a regular, hardworking citizen, I realize that the Second Amendment is not going anywhere. Right now as we speak, I'm sitting here in my truck. I got a 40 cal strapped around my chest. I have a CC license, so I carry concealed. Since I've been out of here, it's only been one incident where a guy had a gun, looked at me and figured, oh, he didn't, and he tried to push up. But after he told me, well, I'm armed. By law, I told him, sir, I put my jacket back and showed him mine, and I said, I'm armed too. But he was in the wrong, so he zipped his lips and went about his business.
Let me ask you this, Will. First of all, how old are you?
I'm 61.
How old do you think he may have been?
He might have been in his 70s.
Okay. So, and we are talking about Texas, where, I speak slightly, partially, tongue in cheek. Everybody is armed in Texas.
Hal? And like I said, I hated to play the devil's advocate, but under the Second Amendment, and it happened out here 3 months ago where a lady was sitting at the store. The guy grabbed her door, yanked it open, and he was getting ready to jack up for a car. And she put two in his chest. So I'm saying, how do you take that? And we have the castle law here. But how do you take the rights away from the good citizen to protect yourself from the bad guy?
That's
my issue.
And I won't speak for my guests. But again, I think in defense of what, the chief was saying, what happened to you is exactly the kind of incident that he was talking about where cooler heads prevail. And which is why you're talking to me now, and why that man who you said was in the wrong is probably walking around somewhere right now, because somebody thought better of pulling out their gun and shooting someone else. But the issue here, and I'll ask Ryan about that. But that is not what is happening in these communities.
No, most of the guns in D.C. a larger number of the guns in D.C. are illegal guns, right? So people are being killed by illegal guns finding their way into this city. And as the chief said, and I, in every interview and every moment I have, tell people we have no gun stores, some of the strictest gun laws on the books in D.C., and don't manufacture guns. So why is our police department collecting over 2,000 illegal, almost 2,000 illegal guns every year on our streets? You, in the good guy scenario of gun owners, some of those things come out well, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the illegal guns that find their way onto D.C. streets, killing black and brown children and people every single day, and how we deal with that as a gun owner. How do you secure your guns? How do you store your guns that if there was a robbery in your house, that those guns aren't stolen and sold illegally?
I lived in PG County for 16 years. I kept a weapon in the house as well. But my thing is, when the law is passed to carry, the bad guy think twice about who he steps to.
I disagree because if you got a hothead who want to have a Wild Wild West moment with you, he's not or she's not going to think about that moment. I totally disagree with that.
And if I can just jump, I think that there's a sometimes you're thinking about it with that one-on-one situation. Mm-hmm. Is our cooler heads going to prevail or they're going to not? But I think there's a lot of collateral consequences to having wide amounts of guns that cause problems. One, obviously, is that sometimes guns aren't secured and kids get them. But from a civil rights and civil liberties standpoint, when you have a situation where there are tons of guns flooding communities, people want to take actions to cover the risk of cooler heads not prevailing. And that means government coming in and intruding on our rights. It means more metal detectors in schools. It means programs like Stop and Frisk. So the sort of political climate where you can have more invasive government violations of rights often is connected to having more guns in the community. So there are complicated issues about gun control policy that we don't necessarily want to get into at this moment. But I think that it's important to think about the whole array of consequences that come in this sort of an issue.
Well, thank you so much for your phone call. I appreciate it. In the couple of minutes that I have, Ryan, what do you want to see come out of the efforts that you are participating in Ward 8 with your organization, but even more to the point, in addressing some of the issues of deadly gun violence in the district? What do you want to see?
I think that we have to educate ourselves on how urban gun violence manufactured itself. You talked about the crack cocaine epidemic in the 80s and 90s. We're still dealing with the ramifications of that today, because those are the children and grandchildren of those people who either ran illegal drugs and guns, were killed, or are in prison now. We have to deal with the systemic issues around affordable housing, education, schools. Our schools, schools east of the river suffer greatly. Rotating administrators. I think it's the systemic issues that we have to deal with in order to get to the problem, the behavioral health, trauma centers. And the mayor has called for trauma centers east of the river, but they had to manufacture themselves. Like, come, stop throwing good money behind bad programs and things like that. Like, it starts from the systemic issues and it has to work itself up from the ground up, that it touches the people that it needs to touch.
Michael, real quick, what do you hope will come out of this lawsuit against the police department and in this case? Do you think that this is a one-off, or do you think that this could actually portend changes?
We certainly hope this will portend changes, and we hope that the chief will act on what he was saying today and make sure that the types of searches that happened to our client and happened to many of our other clients and people who have contacted our office don't happen anymore. And I just want to kind of echo what Ryan was saying. In this moment where there are so many concerns about homicides and gun violence, I think it's incredibly important that we not respond by calling in the police to commit more aggressive tactics. The solution to gun violence isn't police violence. It's investment, like Ryan was talking about. And I think all of us as community members need to keep that in mind as we think about the problems we're facing as a city.
Ryan Nickens, Michael Perloff, thank you both for talking to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Wednesday, January 15th, 2020. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.